So it's not then all of a sudden the happiness that we think we wanted is achieved. It's a different quality. It's not the happiness that is the momentary. I got my ice cream and it's like this and it goes away.
Hi, I'm Ebony, and I believe that stories change lives, and everyone has a story worth telling. Sometimes, unfortunately, we let our self-doubt get in the way of us writing our stories and sharing our stories. So that's why I created Motivation to Write as a source of motivation and inspiration to help writers like you and me share our stories with the world. So I talk to the experts ranging from entrepreneurs to marketers to authors to therapists to psychologists who share their knowledge and their advice to help writers like you and me step into our full potential. Alex Boyajanu is a psychotherapist with over 30 years of experience. His approach to therapy is holistic, as he integrates psychology and philosophy to help people understand themselves and heal their trauma. Alex is trained in EMDR, a technique used to help people process and resolve trauma successfully. He is also a gifted couples therapist, assisting the partners to reach deep levels of awareness and compassion. With compassion and discernment, Alex guides and models how to harness the energies we all possess to rediscover our true selves. Hello, Alex. Thank you so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm excited to do this, Ebony.
I am excited too, because you're a therapist. Who doesn't love talking to a therapist? Well, I like therapists. And, you know, I was just thinking about this, Alex, because as writers, we can write a lot about traumas in our lives and about very difficult topics. I was actually talking to a few authors this week where we were talking about vulnerability and how vulnerable you have to be to share some of these very traumatic events in your life and writing. And a lot of times we need to accompany that with therapy. Sometimes we just need therapy to help process some of this pain that we go through. And I know you do a lot of like psycho-spiritual growth type things in your therapy. And I can't wait. So Alex, tell us a little bit about your background.
I think I'll begin with my own spiritual recognition at an early age. In my teenage years, I was very curious about, you know, why are we here? What's the purpose of my life? Mm-hmm. That was something within me at a very, very early age. And then when I was in probably around high school, I started to realize that no matter what I do, no matter what I build, no matter what I achieve, it's all going to slip away. It's impermanent is really the key quality that's the term that we use in Buddhism. It's the quality of impermanence. And when I experienced that, it really shook the foundation of who am I and why am I here even more. If everything that I'm going to do, you know, based on social structures of, let's say, you know, go to college, let's say get married, you know, all the things that we often are kind of like conditioned to believe and think, for me, that wasn't enough. There was some kind of inner calling for something much more fundamental and much more universal at the same time. And that began my journey, my own journey. And that was, you know, around 16, 17, I'm 53. So I've been doing it for almost 40 years in terms of, and I ended up particularly in an Eastern stream of philosophical, spiritual thought. But when you go deeper into it, it doesn't belong to the East, it belongs to humanity. And which is fundamentally is that we are all pure consciousness, divine beings, fundamentally, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So, and then began my interest in college. I took a couple of college psychology courses, and it just really just connected the two spheres together for me. And I went on to, you know, study psychology and Eastern thought for my life. That's where I've been intersecting between the two. And as we get into it, you'll start to see that spiritual and psychological are not two different things. They're interwoven aspects of the psyche. You can't separate them two. And as we get into it, we'll talk about the different dynamics and the parts that are what we call psychology and what we call spirituality.
Okay. So then I think it's really interesting, this idea of impermanence, because we're always, at least I can speak for myself, like throughout my life, always kind of seeking something in the moment to make me feel whole or to make me happy. And
That's
then,
right.
yeah, and those things are fleeting. Like you get the car, you get the house, you get whatever. And then the next day you want something else.
Correct. And that's what drove me. My question was, can I experience the fullness without the grasping onto what's impermanent? You see?
Yeah.
And the answer was yes. And that's what I have been working on within myself to stabilize. And you used a great term, which is wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really look at what we're doing all day long, I mean, you have to really break down our motivation to grasp at people, places, things, and experiences, right? These are the you know, things that we're grasping on externally. I mean, internally, we can say we're grasping on to thoughts, emotions, sensations, and perceptions, right? Or dreams. But in all of those graspings, internal, external, the hope there is to actually resolve the craving. So let me give you an example. Let's say I want some ice cream, and I go eat the ice cream. In the moment of eating the ice cream, what's the experience? Is it the taste of the ice cream that I enjoy? Yes, but I also enjoy not wanting the ice cream in that moment as well. You see, so that in the moment, there's a small relief of the craving itself, right?
Yeah.
That's the more essential, what I call ontological experience that we're seeking. We actually want to end all of our suffering of seeking and to experience wholeness without seeking.
Wow. If we really achieve that, would we even be happy? Because it seems, isn't that like a great story? You need a conflict and then you need to resolve the conflict. If we went through life having
That's a story. That's still a story we tell ourselves in the human condition. That's still a story. You have to look at that. Everything is a story until we experience that wholeness as an embodied experience, not in our minds. And all of my teachers who I've been for many years, I've seen them achieve that. I myself know how to access that wholeness and to live that way throughout my life, through good portions of my day in my life. And so it's not then all of a sudden the happiness that we think we wanted is achieved. It's a different quality. It's not the happiness that is the momentary, I got my ice cream and it's like this and it goes away.
Right.
It's a deep, deep coming home. A sense of, let me give you the qualities that you can, fullness, wholeness, completeness, you know, all these words, right? It's spacious. It's timeless. It has love. It has power. It has sensuality. It has voice. It has clarity. Those are the qualities of us abiding as our fundamental true self.
Mm.
And those qualities we don't have to make. They're there.
Mm-hmm.
What blocks them is our conditioning in this human, you know, realm that we're in. There's no way that we can get away from being conditioned by our lives.
Mm.
And you know, the real good work to do with people is to help them simply, the process is to uncondition.
Okay. So I feel sometimes that I am addicted to pain or suffering. It's almost like I feel like there's this need, like I don't know if it's unconscious, but there has to be something that I am unhappy about or scared of or is that about?
All right, so if you can experience, go inside your body at this moment right now. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll guide just so you can see it.
Yeah.
Notice what's driving the grasping. See if you can get in touch with what is it that you're actually grasping on. You call it pain and suffering, right? That's what you said is the addiction.
Mm-hmm.
what does that make you experience when you grasp on to pain? What do you experience?
In my body, like anxiety?
In your body. That's right. So it doesn't relieve you, does it?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And then when you experience the anxiety, then what happens? What do you do then?
Then I start crying.
and probably seeking more pain and suffering.
Right.
My point is this. Every grasping is functional. I want you to remember that. Okay? Just this is a very important term. Every grasping is functional. I don't care if it's grasping to what we call negative or what we call positive. That's irrelevant to me. Grasping is grasping because the end result there is relief. So watch what happens. If I'm anxious and I grew up in an anxious home, and one way to get away from my own anxiety is to seek pain. So I'd rather distract myself with the pain than feel the constant state of anxiety.
You'd rather distract yourself with the pain than feel the constant state of anxiety.
Correct. And the constant state of anxiety is always there for almost all of us unless we've done the work, even if we're not aware of it on a very subtle level. And what is that anxiety? The anxiety is nothing but energy.
Right.
That's agitated from us not being whole. You see how we return again here?
Okay.
So therefore, the answer to your question is that you're seeking the grasping into that experience. So let's just call it experience. Doesn't matter if it's negative or positive. Experience.
Yeah.
To resolve the experience that you don't know how to resolve.
Right.
Which is the function of not feeling whole.
Okay.
Full circle.
Right. Okay. So then, how do we achieve this feeling of wholeness?
So we often think that it's a feeling. It's not necessarily a feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine grasping onto something really tight, right?
Yeah.
And then just releasing it. Mm-hmm. I don't care. Let's say it's a ball and you're holding the ball really tight and you release it. In that moment of releasing, what's the experience? What's the experience?
It's a relief.
It's a relief. And tell me, describe the quality of the relief. Take your pen right now and grasp your pen really tight, right? Yeah. And then just drop it like this. Now experience. Notice what you're experiencing immediately. What's the quality?
Calm.
Very good. What else? Let's give it some names.
I feel
freedom from holding that.
Yeah. So
yeah. Try it again. That's right.
Yeah, okay, I just want to do one more.
It's experience. That's right. Yeah, that's right. Go ahead, go internally and intuit it. There you go.
I take this like long exhale.
Breath. That's right. Yeah. What's the exhale? What's the exhale about? The exhale is the release.
Right. Yeah.
It's the unburdening of carrying something and grasping on something. So therefore, the path is the letting go of all of our conditioning and our baggage.
Wow. Yeah.
Mindfully and with effort. This takes work. And if you read any of the great masters of humanity, and then also talk to people who are on the path, this is a deep dedication that requires daily mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
That is based on a commitment that I want to experience my wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be minor. Like, oh, I want happiness. Like, it can't be some kind of like, you know, frou-frou kind of thing. It's gotta be a real commitment to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the amount of energy that's needed to let go of that energy that's been built up all this time,
mm-hmm.
that needs work.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about the stages that are needed for that work, but the key is, I call it effortless effort, and I'll describe why. Effortless effort.
Okay.
embodiment, mm-hmm. perseverance and determination with mindfulness daily, right? Mm-hmm. And we do need a guide. It's impossible to do by ourselves. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can't unshackle yourself.
When you say guide, you mean professional.
It could be a spiritual guide. It could be a professional. It could be a pastor. It could be mm-hmm. it could be the person down the street who is committed. To me, it doesn't matter who it is, as long as that person understands within themselves on how to attain, you know, the quality of wholeness, and then can guide someone.
Right.
And that's not everybody can do that. That's a unique individual. It's right. Not everybody, and not every therapist knows how to do that.
Right. Okay. So what I'm imagining, Alex, is that we all have wholeness. Like we are. Yes. Okay. We are all whole, but there's been so much like trauma and all this stuff that's happened that's kind of like buried it where we can't even experience it because it's underneath all this stuff.
Correct.
And then so we got to excavate to get to experience okay. Yes. That's a tall order. As you said, it does take a lot of perseverance. Yeah. So I know you, so negative traumas can produce negative patterns in our lives. Like how does that, especially in our relationships, how does that happen?
Great topic. Big topic. Great topic. All right. So I teach about this and lecture about this all the time. So let's go from the beginning. Okay. Let's start at the beginning. When we come into the world, our initial contact to the world is through our nervous system. It's very important to understand that. When we are embryonic, what's laid down first is the nervous system. When the sperm and egg connect and they start to split, what happens is that the nervous system is laid down to move things along, right? Well, so the nervous system is the interface between our internal environment and our external environment. Mm-hmm. And what is the nervous system connected to? It's connected to the brain, right? So the brain and the nervous system are in constant dialogue about the environment and what are we doing? Not consciously, this is all unconscious. We're assessing for danger, for survival. And then if we have that, we can move along Maslow's hierarchy of going to self-actualization, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Well, if the nervous system is not given the right environment to grow, and we know this with children, right? Then what happens is they have to take all their energy for survival and dealing with the environment and the people and the circumstances instead of their own wholeness, okay? So none of us gets away from this. Being human means you're going to be conditioned. Nobody gets away without being conditioned, okay? The difference is that there's a range. So since all human beings are imperfect in their ability to parent, all right? Mm-hmm. That means we have parents all the way from one side to the other side. From the one side, they've done good work on themselves. Mm-hmm. And they create the environment that is the closest to the child's ability to access wholeness. Because the parents themselves also know how to access that. Okay? Then we go all the way to the other side of what we call, you know, the worst severe form of parenting that you could imagine.
Yeah.
All right? And, you know, we could imagine what that looks like, all right? So as we move along this scale, okay, the level and intensity of trauma rises. Mm-hmm. What is trauma? Let's understand the word. The word trauma, it comes from the Greek word, trauma, which means to rupture. Look at this beautiful word. Rupture, it means rupture. Rupture from what? I have to rupture from my own wholeness and now create a coping mechanism to deal with my environment and the people within it. So I've become ruptured, separated from trauma separates us. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens? What's the micro processes that happen? So let's do an example. Let's say, I'm cooking something. I make it up as a child and I'm helping cook something and something falls on the floor. Mom or dad screams at me.
Mm-hmm.
You're so stupid. In that moment, my desire for cooking, the natural, all of a sudden, now I have to deal with the fact that I've been screamed at. That's traumatizing. Number two is I've been told I'm stupid. What does the child internalize in that moment? The internal process says now there must be something wrong with me.
Mm.
So the moment the child internalizes that there's something wrong with them, further rupture inside of them from their wholeness. Now, what are they going to get focused on? Uh-oh, I need to deal with me being bad. So I need to do something about this to make it good. Mommy, daddy, I'm so sorry. Do you want me to do something? I'll go clean more. Or what do I need to do to repair that? And now they get into a vicious cycle of negative feelings and then the persona compensation for that to heal what's going on outside. Okay. What do we call that? We call that it's kind of like the archetype. It's the caretaker, the good one, let's say, mm-hmm. or the child who gets in trouble. There's like 300 names for the different kind of roles that we all start to play, mm-hmm. right? You and I can come up with the different names for all those roles that people play.
Mm-hmm.
Once those roles play for a certain amount of time, we believe that that's the only way to life. That's us. That's my identity.
Okay, I think I get it. So you experience something that is traumatic, and then your response is to take on this particular role.
Correct. With the negative self-perception underneath it all. That's the worst part.
With the negative self-perception, yeah.
Because that's what creates the shame and the guilt. Mm. That's why so many people suffer from shame and guilt, because they feel ashamed and guilty for being themselves.
Right, okay, right. Because you've believed that there's something inherently wrong with you.
Correct, correct.
Okay. Oh, correct. My goodness. So that...
And what does that cause down the road, right? It causes the two main symptoms, anxiety and depression. Look at this. In the United States, the number one and two reasons why people seek out therapy, psychiatry, their general practitioners, is anxiety and depression. I just want you to understand that. Mm-hmm. In the United States of America, there is more Lexapro prescribed than every other drug combined.
Wow. Wow.
So what does that say? And the research is very clear. The research proved that it's not because people actually have a serotonin deficiency in their brain. Mm-hmm. It's because there's trauma. So therefore, 8 out of 10 people who receive those medications have no benefit to them, because the problem is not serotonin.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Alex, how can we begin, so how can we get off the drugs?
We got to deal with the trauma.
Yeah.
Got to deal with the trauma.
Yeah. I think today, I'd say within the last maybe 10 or 15 years, it's become a little bit more socially acceptable to seek out help, seek out a therapist. I feel like prior to that, though, there was just a lot of embarrassment and even saying that you're seeing it. There still is some. Sure. But how do we encourage people to, it's okay, especially in some communities, in the African-American community, it's still kind of like a no-no thing.
It's a challenge throughout the world, this question. And it really is dominated by the materialistic worldview that we are separated from our bodies. We are a mind. So we have a classic Cartesian dualism that I am my thinking and I am not my body. And when that happens, is then there's a lot of negative perceptions built around that throughout the world, in many communities, different cultures, different races, different religions, right? Because now all of a sudden we're going to have to deal with that, what seems in the shadow stuff that has to come out, right? Or another way of saying that, all that suppressed material. And you got to remember something, the community's take on the belief of the, also the individual, is that we ourselves are so uncomfortable to deal with the material. Nobody has taught us how to deal with it. So therefore, we then as a community get together to suppress, look at this, to suppress the unconscious. So now we have communal unconscious repressions, right? Countries that have sort of say suppression on the shadow side of the psyche. So
is that so that shadow side is shame?
The shadow side is the material that I don't want to see, which is what? There's something wrong with me.
Right.
I don't know what to do with that. It's too overwhelming.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to go and sit down with you and start off a conversation by being like, look, you know, Ebony, I feel like a piece of shit. No, I'm going to hide that. I'm going to do everything I can to not to deal with that. But that's going to permeate through me. That's going to permeate in the way I walk, in the way I talk, in the way I think, and what I do. So it's not that the shadow doesn't inform us. That's the crazy part about it. We believe that the shadow, because it's in the shadow, doesn't affect us. No, if I had an elephant come into my closet and take a big poop in there, even if it's in my closet, it's going to smell throughout my whole house.
Right.
So sorry for the analogy, but that's what happens.
Yeah.
It smells and influences everything. There's no way to get away from it.
Yeah.
So you had asked a question about relationships, right?
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
I don't know if you want to, I mean, I could wait until later if you want to, you know.
No, let's talk. Can we talk about that now? Because when you get
absolutely
new people who have been through trauma in a relationship, taking on these roles. Yeah.
All right. So about 25, 30 years ago, the field of marriage and family therapy and understanding really shifted with the work of Harville Hendricks.
Yes, I love Harville Hendricks.
Harville is an amazing, and when I was, you know, 25 years younger, before actually I think it was even, in the whole imago therapy understanding of the human being was profound. What does that mean? Whatever is cut off in me, I'm going to play out with you. Whatever is cut off with you, you're going to play out with me. And we're going to do everything we can to re-trigger what that is and yet not deal with it at the same time. That's the craziness of the cycle. So whatever I hide from you is going to get played out, and I'm going to pull you into that. So it's a perfect match. Imago means that we're a perfect match to activate the trauma and not deal with it at the same time. Incredible.
And you naturally attract someone like this to you.
It's not a matter, it's so funny we say it that way. It's more that we get attracted to someone.
Right.
I want to be careful. I was like, you know, it's like if you get together with 100 people, there'll be some weird kind of like thing.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, hey, you want to talk? And bam.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because somehow there's a feeling tone that both of you will play out like, hey, we're not going to touch my stuff. We're not going to touch your stuff. Okay. So the more trauma, the more chaos, the more dysfunction then within the couplehood.
And how, because I think he, one of, a part of his, because it's him and his wife, right?
I think that they say that
you will naturally be attracted to someone who has very similar qualities as your parents.
Yes, that's right. Right, because that's what creates the enactment, you understand? So there'll be a particular quality, maybe one or both parents, you know, it can be, but then that'll enact you. So you'll, why? Let's look at the reason why.
Yeah.
In the unconscious, the person is hoping to resolve it in that interaction. So let's say a woman picks someone similar to her father, and her father, let's say, had anger issues, right? Mm-hmm. What she hopes to do is that she'll find the angry man, her father, mm-hmm. and then she'll change him.
Mm.
And by changing him, he's no longer angry, and she feels better.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fantasy, by the way. But because she's coming from a place that's still splintered and fractured and seems, you know, broken, she's going to enact with him to pull the rage out of him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not that she'll know how to, in a mindful, conscious way, to create the atmosphere for both of them to do that. No, she'll be enacting it, because in order to really then deal with it, she's going to have to deal with her shadow. So you see, it's all about maintaining the shadow and letting the reenactment keep happening without the resolution. I know it sounds crazy, but it's what happens.
So when you get those two people together, because what ultimately usually happens is they split because it just becomes too much to deal Correct. With the other person's
Correct.
Stuff.
Correct. Correct.
Is that the only solution, or what should, I don't know if should is the right word, but what's the healthy way to deal with these traumatic pattern or these trauma patterns that occur in relationships besides just running away? I mean, it seems like at times you might, if it gets abusive.
You hope that and often I see this, by the way, many people come to me, either they're in a relationship like this, or they've come out of one and they want to understand themselves. They realize somewhere around the age of 30 that they've done three relationships that look almost identical.
Right, yeah.
Around 30, 32, right?
Yeah.
Because that gives enough time to practice a couple of them, right? You need a couple of them, right?
Yeah.
And then you look back and you go, oh shit, like that was the same, that was the same, that was the same. I need to go talk to someone.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beginning.
Hmm. Mm. Yeah, that usually, I've noticed that myself. You run, or I've run away from man number one. Man number two is like man number one in a different suit.
That's right.
You're right.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
That's right. It's the same dynamic, just dressed up differently, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then, how does this tie in? Now I'm into the relationship thing, because this is interesting. How does this tie in to attachment styles?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So when you look at Levine's book called Attached, which is an incredible book,
yeah,
he talks about the different styles. You know, sometimes you'll see three different styles talking about attached, to some places name four of them. But you have the secure attachment, and then you have all of the other attachments that are not secure, you know, right. Between the anxious clingy, anxious avoidant, and then the mixed type, we call it, right?
Right.
So we believe at this point that some of this has to do with some wiring, okay? And then the environment. What I've seen and what the research is showing, and you know, I have to go back to it again, is that people usually end up 50 to 75% of the time with their mother's attachment style.
Mm. Okay?
So I don't know why. We don't know why, but that just seems to be somewhere, you know, along the lines. And I think it's a genetic influence, which predisposes us towards temperament, right? Certain temperaments. Mm-hmm. And then combined with the family environment, those two on top of it together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the influence of attachment styles.
Hmm. Okay. So let's say that we recognize, you know, our trauma. We've seen how it plays out in relationships, and we're seeking help through therapy. What are some what happens if you have trust issues with your therapist? Are there any red flags that we should look out for? I guess is really what I'm asking when seeking therapy.
Sure. There's a couple. I want to deconstruct what you said here for a moment. You have to understand that most people coming into therapy for the first time,
yeah,
are going to feel awkward.
Mm-hmm.
They they don't know what the process is going to be like. They don't understand what the dynamics will be, right? That's number one. So they're already walking in into that uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Number two is if they already have trust issues,
yeah,
then those are going to get played out. So let me make this a much broader sentence to you instead of just trust. We bring our baggage to our therapist.
Right. Of course. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So whatever is going to be our stuff that gets played out with everybody else is going to get played out with our therapist. Mm-hmm. So any good therapy will allow that person to go ahead and play that out in the therapy room to bring that forward in a safe way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then we can use all that material to heal and start to heal it between two human beings and then to practice extending that out into their life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. All right. It's important to understand.
I've known someone who was always like bouncing from therapist to therapist to therapist.
Yes.
And it just seemed a little odd that.
There could be a couple of different reasons for that. One, you know, we call it therapy shopping. You know, it's okay. Like,
yeah.
it's either really that someone is not a good match. You know, it's okay.
Yeah.
But that would, you know, or they're running away from it, right? Okay. So it's hard to say which one it is.
Yeah.
Now let's talk a little bit about the process of evaluating your therapist. This is important that you do that. All right. So what do we do? What do we want to look for? I train therapists, so you know, for me, in training therapists, I take a lot of pride in making sure that they, you know, really embody all the characteristics that we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
So, number one, the therapist has to do their own work on themselves. You know, they should be involved in some form of self-actualization within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe also the therapist should be training and participating with other professionals, maybe, or with guides who, you know, really hold position where they can continue to evolve themselves, right? I think our whole life one should continue to evolve that way.
Mm. Yeah.
Therapists should do that as well. Number two, a therapist should be aware and very understanding on a deep level of what goes on with every single human being as an overall view of the philosophical and psychological world. Meaning, many therapists just sit with their clients and just talk about how are you, what's going on, and let's talk about sort of say how is your day or your week, or just talk around the topic, or just every week is just, you know, or give or provide answers. That's not the point. Mm. Or to answer questions. Right. No. That's not what the therapist is here for. The therapist helps guide the person into their own wholeness.
Mm.
And then so that person outside the room knows how to do that on their own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
What's that analogy? Teach someone to fish and I forget how it goes, right?
Yeah, 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 yeah. Don't give him a fish. Teach him how to fish so he can basically support himself. Yeah. So that's interesting. So your therapist should not be telling you what to do.
No.
Right.
No, I don't. I don't tell my clients what to do.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I know that. Like there are some therapists that will work with meditation, and I know that meditation is very powerful, especially something called mindfulness meditation. Can you talk a little bit about that? What is that?
Sure. Let's do a little bit of background to understand this. In the 1950s and 60s, there was the beginnings of yoga coming to the West, as well as Buddhism coming to the West. These were the early days. and in Europe and also in the States and the UK. And what came from the East was a really deep understanding of what creates suffering and what creates and supports wholeness. Very deep understanding, right? And there's a clear pathway and ways, methods that we call methods, on how to do that. Mm-hmm. So mindfulness comes out of those traditions and has been supplanted in the West and has been quite misunderstood by a lot of people. And I'm kind of on a crusade, to be honest with you, for people to really understand what is mindfulness, what is meditation as a direct experience, and so they're not confused. And I lead meditation courses, and so far it's been incredible, and people love them, and they often stop therapy, to be honest with you. Mm. Often stop therapy because it's so powerful in itself, right? So meditation, the word meditation comes from a Tibetan Buddhist term named gom. Gom means familiarity.
Hmm.
It's really interesting. It's to become familiar with one's own wholeness.
Hmm.
So the path of meditation is the journey of coming home.
Hmm. It's excavating through all that stuff.
That's what meditation and that's what meditation does. And meditation works with the three parts of the psyche. Now, this gets a little technical, so bear with me here for a moment, right? So this way, it'll make sense when it all comes together. So in our everyday experience, every moment of our experience, there are three components of the psyche that are happening. One, the objects of experience, thoughts, emotions, and sensations.
Mm-hmm.
Just, okay, you got that. We call that the known, K, known. Those are the objects. Then there's the knower, the mm-hmm. subject.
Mm-hmm.
Subject, object, right? It's that sense of self
mm-hmm.
that is observing or a witness to or experiencing the objects.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then there is the knowing, the third K. That's simply just awareness, presence, pure knowing without any history or conditioning. It's the ability to be present in the moment
mm-hmm.
without all of the filters of the past. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening to us all the time at every second of our existence. Why do we need meditation? Here's why. We assume that I am my thoughts, emotions, and sensations.
Right.
Well, if I was my thoughts, emotions, and sensations, then every time I had a thought, I would become that thought. Well, we slowly realize or quickly realize that all day long, you're having experience, but that experience comes and goes.
Right.
Wait a second. That's very interesting. Most people don't pay attention to that. They're like, they don't have a moment to say, I had a thought, it went by. Well, I can't say I am my thought then. There's an emotion. Wait a second. That came and went. So therefore, we start to get curious about the subject, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who is this that is observing
right.
the experience? Now, before we get there, we all walk around saying, I am my experience. I am the object of my experience. When we're at that stage, there's a lot of suffering that goes on, a lot of suffering. And we're not aware of our wholeness. Mindfulness, meditation practice, overall, mindfulness belongs under the heading of meditation. It's one of the categories, right? Meditation is the overarching methods. Mm-hmm. Mindfulness is within that, right? What do? We learn to meditate, become mindful, most of the time on our breath to start with. Let's say the breath. So we sit here, we open our eyes or close our eyes, and we simply pay attention to the inflow and outflow of the breath.
Mm-hmm.
Look what you experience right away, a calmness,
mm-hmm.
an ease, right away, immediately. Mm-hmm. And notice as you're being mindful of your breath, right? What happens to your thoughts, emotions, and sensations?
I don't even think about them.
You mean you're not even aware of them?
Aware of them, yeah. Yeah.
I'm not even aware of them. Exactly. So what happened is your mindfulness, look at this, and we can take the word mindfulness and basically say, where are we minding? Remember, the word minding means to do something with the information, with the content, minding. Mm-hmm. So we get to choose. I'm minding the unconscious material and the objects of experience, or I am mindful of who I am and my wholeness. That first step allows what I call the disengagement from the object side.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the first step of meditation is to give us room from the story.
Mm.
Such a good step. Imagine you're inside of a movie theater, right?
Yeah.
And here's the big screen playing. It's one of those huge screens, an IMAX, right?
Yeah.
And you're sitting right there facing the movie. What are you going to say? I am my thoughts, I'm my emotions, I'm my sensations.
Right.
Yes, yeah. I'm all these belief systems because I'm inside this big IMAX movie.
Yeah.
What do? Meditation practice allows you to step back, and then go all the way to the last seat up in the bleachers. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
First
I love
step.
That analogy. That's a wonderful analogy. Oh my gosh. Move all the way to the back row of the theater.
Back row of the theater.
Yeah.
The second step of meditation is now we turn our attention on the subject side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this observer?
Mm-hmm.
That allows us to start to see the lens, right, by which we see life. And one of the biggest ahas that we have is we realize that the objects of experience are simply the projections of the lens that we're carrying, meaning they're not happening to us.
Mm.
They're happening from us.
Mm.
We are the ones projecting onto the movie screen, not the movie screen towards us.
Wow.
Therefore, when we do this work, the quality, the nature, intensity of thinking, emotions, and sensation changes.
Mm. Okay.
You cannot change your experience of the object side without shifting the lens that actually creates them.
Right. Right.
If it's like me, if I have a river full of pollution and it goes to the fields to make my food, I can't, if I try to keep cleaning the water on the other side and I just keep, don't change from where it's coming from.
Right.
What's going to keep happening?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I have to go to the source, to the place of where it originates from. And what's the origin? It's the negative self-perception. Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
That deep feeling that there's something wrong with me creates all these patterns.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the third stage of meditation.
Yeah.
Embodied within the body, we go deeper into the center of our being, into the purity of simply the knower, the knowing quality.
Yeah.
That is free and whole of the whole story.
Mm.
And there's no longer any negative subject or negative objects of experience.
Mm.
Deep, deep, deep peace.
Okay.
So mindfulness and meditation do these, they work on these three parts.
And so, first of all, wow, that's just hearing you describe that is just, I feel at ease and calmer just hearing the process described. Right. How, so like on a, just on a practical level, if someone's sitting down to try this out, they start with the breath?
Look, again, it's the same thing. The methods need to be guided by someone who knows the methods. Otherwise people are going to go to some hokey person that's offering a weekend workshop who themselves hasn't practiced for 30, 40 years. And as it took one little course on mindfulness somewhere and now wants to teach it to someone.
Okay.
You know, it's gotta be with someone who has taken the time, who's done the work, who's had teachers who've, you know, really acknowledged that they've done the work. Give them the light that to go ahead and do this with people, you know, or they can go get an app if they want and then go on the app. And what happens? They get frustrated and they're like, oh, but I can't clear my mind. Well, that's not what meditation is supposed to do anyway. And so what happens is they give up on the whole huge beneficial field because of misinformation.
Right. Yeah. And that's the big frustration with meditation that I hear a lot is that I can't set my mind. It's just, I can't, like the thoughts just keep coming.
That's not what we're doing.
Right. But you know, Alex, so what if like you're just at home and you're feeling anxious, like, because this is what I do. I will sit down and I will just breathe. I will take inhales and exhales and audibly so I could hear myself very slowly, like a...
Beautiful. You got the first step of it, right? So let's talk about the importance of breath here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's so incredible, by the way, that we don't understand the power of the breath. And let me say this to you. When a person is traumatized, the nervous system responds. What happens to the breath during trauma?
Oh, you hold it. It's like,
correct.
Yeah.
Right? All right. So look what happens then. Once we hold it enough, the system then takes on that holding pattern unconsciously, believing that your whole life now needs this level of attentiveness to being anxious. Okay. All right, brain and nervous system, we need to be on guard now all the time. So unconsciously, let's hold our breath in that pattern because that's what's actually happening. By the time we're adults, we are breathing with only 50 to 25% capacity of our full oxygenation of breath.
Wow.
Let's talk about the impact of that. The impact of that is a reduction in the feeding, first of all of our cells.
Right. Yeah.
Talk about the creating diseases. Number two is we're creating the release of adrenaline and cortisol, which is the stress response, on a constant level, which then creates a depletion in the body, and the body starts to feel tired. So fatigue is the next thing
that
we experience. Mm-hmm. Why am I so tired? Because you're running like this, like this all the time. mm-hmm. What else do we experience? A level of anxiety and agitation that maybe even not aware of, but it's like this, right? So I teach breath to everybody. Nothing complicated, simply full breathing all the way down into the belly, what we call into the belly, because the diaphragm extends all the way down. And if you've seen yogis do the breathing, their diaphragm can squeeze all their internal organs down, mm-hmm. and the belly expands all the way and all the way to the back. That's a full, what we call a full yogic breath. Mm-hmm. And we do that mindfully. Mm-hmm. And then feel that that breath not only extends down into your belly. Now feel that your feet are also experiencing the breath all the way from your feet. Feel that your feet are breathing now. There you go. And now feel that your legs, both left and right leg, are breathing from your feet. All the way from the feet, both legs are now breathing. Ah, you have a body. You're embodied. Now breathing all the way into your arms and your chest and your belly and your neck. Your whole body is breathing all the way up to your head. We call this the full body breathing. Full body breathing.
Yeah.
Feels good, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. This is a great place to start.
Yeah.
Great place to start. You're doing your dishes. Mm-hmm. Going for a walk. Drinking your coffee. Yeah. You know? That's it right there. Yeah. And that brings you into the mindfulness now. Mm-hmm. The breath is the doorway into the now.
Mm. Oh, that's beautiful. I love that. The breath is the doorway into the now. Yeah. That's beautiful, Alex. Alex, I can't believe we're out of time. This has been wonderful. Oh, my goodness.
Thank you. Great. Great questions. I love them. They're great.
Tell us where we can find you.
The best is my website, journeytowholeness.health.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's all letters, not the number two, journeytowholeness.health. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can find me that way. I'm on Facebook, whatever, you know, I can give you my phone numbers, emails. It doesn't matter. You know, this is what I do all day long, every day with people.
This is beautiful. Thank you so much. I think this was one of my favorite interviews because of the way I felt at the end. I felt so much calmer at the end of the interview. Not that I had been nervous or frantic before, because I wasn't, but there was definitely a stillness that came over me and throughout the conversation, gradually came over me in the conversation. I think it had a lot to do with the breathing that we were doing, the deep breath work. And I highly suggest that if you are interested in any of Alex's services, that you contact him, because we've all experienced trauma in some shape or form and need some help in excavating it so that we can experience our wholeness. So please check out Alex's website. And in the meantime, also check out zazo.com for more episodes. And you can follow me on social media, Twitter at Ebony Haywood. And you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Motivation to Write. Thank you so much for joining me this week. And I look forward to having another fabulous conversation with another fabulous guest next week. Okay, see you then. Bye-bye.